Shiver me timbers, you're listening to the Ship Shape Podcast.
Today on the Ship Shape Podcast, we have Bruce Schwab. Bruce is the main partner of Ocean Planet Energy, the first American to complete the Vendée Globe, an energy geek, a guitarist, a cyclist. It's going to be an interesting conversation. Our hosts today are myself, Meryl Charette. I'm a live aboard on a Tashing Toshiba 36 in Boston, Massachusetts, and T.
What's up, guys? This is Talabachi joining you from Virginia. I'm aboard my Lures 40-foot power yacht, and we have with us Bruce Schwab. And he's basically a legend. He's done a lot in the sailing world already. So welcome to the show, Bruce.
Hey. Yeah. Glad to meet virtually.
Yeah.
Where are you?
I'm talking to you from Woolwich, Maine.
Nice. Great to have you on the show.
We're in a rebuilt former Grange Hall here where Ocean Planet Energy is based that was restored by none other than Nigel Calder, one of our partners, and it's a great place. And Maine's a cool place to work on boats because there's plenty of boats in Maine, so it's a good place to be.
Well, You know, the core of who you are is certainly tied to sailing. So I have to ask, what does sailing mean to you?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I was lucky that some of my cruising, I guess the trajectory that a lot of people's lives will go through is they may do racing and then eventually want to dream of cruising, then go cruising. Well, my dad took myself and my two younger brothers out for a 3-year cruise when we were young, and I missed 2 years of school. I missed half of eighth grade, all of ninth grade, and half of 10th grade. And I still managed to graduate from high school in time. And so I did a lot of cruising when I was young, and I always dreamed of racing. Racing is what I wanted to do. And so my dad eventually bought a boat that was hired, a performance boat, which whole another story that we can get into that now I have years later. And I wound up working on boats in California and Washington, and got into ocean racing and did a number of races to Hawaii, you know, the Transpac and Pac Cup, single-handed Transpac, lots of San Francisco Bay Area racing. I was involved in the Single Hand Sailing Society and the racing crowd around there for many years while I worked as a yacht rigger for the most part for almost 20 years and Bay Area. And then I went off on the tangent that got the most attention in 99 2000. I got the bug to try and race around the world.
What got you interested into that?
I was good at the shorthanded racing scene in the Bay Area. I won the single-handed Transpac. I won a lot of local races on the West Coast. And I thought, well, you know, I seem to be good at this. What should I do next? And I had not been a big fan of the Around Alone and Vendée Globe events. I sort of followed them, but I thought those people were crazy and who would want to go for so far. But then I followed Brad Van Loo, who did a great job in the Around Alone. It used to be the BOC race in the Around Alone. And I think 98, 99, he did a great job. And I met him, and he sort of got me going on the bug.
But was it the fact that like Americans weren't winning, or like what got you like super interested?
Yeah, well, he was an American that was winning. He started doing quite good, and I had followed Steve. The guy he acted quite well in the 94-95 BOC. I'll remember his name in a minute here, but Steve, he did a great job. He had some great articles. So the Americans started doing well in the stuff. I started following it, started thinking, well, that could be interesting, and maybe I could be good at that. And then so I started getting some backing together and some folks that wanted to try and do it. And we wound up building Ocean Planet. The original plan of trying to be in the 2000 Vendée Globe, that's the one that Alan MacArthur got second in. That really raised the awareness of it. She did such a fantastic job in that race. And Michelle won it. And so I wanted, but I didn't make it. You know, I wasn't ready. It was a good thing I didn't go because I would have made it. But I made the 2002-2003 Around Alone race.
I made it there.
I managed to finish. I had to stop a couple times to fix stuff. Whole long story about, you know, breaking my new boat and getting used to it. So basically the Around Alone race was my training race for the Vendée, and that qualified me. Well, I tore the boat apart, worked on it for a couple more years, and while I was in Maine, that's when my first extended stint in Maine was from 2003-2004 in Portland, Maine, rebuilding the boat, and then I went to France at the end of 2004 in time for the start, and then 2004-05 Vendée Globe, I managed to finish that and become the first American to finish it, and you know, that whole thing is a long, long story that we could spend quite a bit of time going over how to time manage to, you know, raise and borrow and beg and do whatever it took.
And did you have like a day job in the background while you were doing all the fundraising and everything?
I did in the beginning when I was still working a little bit at Svensson's and doing a little bit of side jobs and stuff. But basically for a few years there, I was a professional beggar to try and raise the backing and support to pull.
How much did you need?
Well, we had no idea. We were just going to try and do it no matter, you know, whoever we got. But in the end, I raised over the whole period of time from starting around 2000 to the whole thing sort of ended, you know, after the Vendée Globe. So it's like 5 or 6 years. I raised $1.7 million.
Nice.
But I spent, in order to build the boat and race twice around the world, we spent about 2.1.
Oh, boy. So still a loss.
Oh, yeah. Big time. And so in the end, I'm not alone in these sailing financial stories. In the end, it didn't turn out so well. I took the fall for the whole thing and, you know, a lot of credit card bills and stuff. And in 2008, along with a lot of other folks, you know, I had to take the fall for the foundation that owned the boat. The foundation got dissolved and a lot of this debt was in my name. But let's put it this way. A few credit card companies lost some money in that in the end. But,
And 2008 was a financial crisis anyway.
Exactly. So, we couldn't sell the boat for very much at the time. We had to sell it. And you know, there's lots of sailing stories that sort of end that way. But the end result was, I wound up pulling off what I wanted to do and what I told everyone I was going to do. That's a key part of it. When you talked, you asked about, you know, how much money you were going to need. You know, one of the things that I learned, if people believe in you, and this is the early days of, you know, crowdfunding and stuff. I mean, to raise that kind of money is just amazing. It's just a blip in the space-time continuum that allowed that to even happen. We had donors from like nearly every state in the country. There's like more than 2,000 different people pitched in, everywhere from, you know, major donors like Kevin and Shauna Flanagan of Oregon, who wound up in the end putting in, you know, big chunks of money.
But that's true, though. This is way before the days of, like, you know, any of the Kickstarters or GoFundMes or anything. So how were you doing this back then?
Email. I was writing stories. I was giving people updates, writing stories from, you know, sailing on the boat, the whole adventure where I was, and writing from at sea, as we, you know, doing around alone, doing my qualifiers. During all that process, we had a great email following, and that was, you know, it's one of the things I need to get going again for my new boat project, but we'll get to that later. But the, as the early days of crowdfunding, I was on the, luckily on the forefront of that, and that wave of getting people interested, and it's just amazing. But what I was going to say is that when people believe in you and you meet them at boat shows and you meet them at fundraisers or you meet them online and they say, okay, I believe you're going to do this. I'm going to write you this check and you check for thousands of dollars. When you get close to the event and you haven't raised enough and you still need more, you still have to go. You told people you were going to do it no matter what. And so you got to do it no matter what. And the chips fall where they may in the end.
So did you, when you went out there, did you feel prepared? How does one prepare for, you know, the Vendée Globe?
Well, the first thing you do is you do a race like the Around Alone first and break a bunch of stuff and get an idea of what you want to fix. And I did a lot of that. But I still was, we were still redoing things up to the final days before the start of the month. And if you follow, you know, many of the boats that are there, you know, except for the very largest budget, most professional experience campaigns, everyone's working until the last
minute. Yep.
Every one of them. And we were putting on solar panels, I think, one night before the start of the race. You know, just getting things done at the last minute. And there was some rigging stuff that I had to finish. I mean, I think in the early days of the race, I went and pulled in to leave one of the Cape Verde Islands or got, not really close, but just a little bit less wind so I could spend more time out on the boom and redoing some reefing lines. And you know, there's stuff to fix all along the way. And I had, you know, I had a great set of stories they were sending out on my email link for all this stuff for a while. It's not online anymore, and I've been meaning to put all the stories back together and get them out there, and or maybe even put them into a book. But I wrote a lot of great stuff.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. A lot of it was on Sailing Anarchy. We had a great relationship with that crazy website, Sailing Anarchy, and they put in all our stories, had a great following there, and through other venues. And you know, once you're in the race, there's lots of exposure there. And they, the stories would go out through different media formats. But I, in the end, I was doing fairly well in the race early on, and then, had various, things to fix like everyone does, and you just keep going. And I mean, everyone has their problems. Conrad Humphreys had to replace his rudder, and, everyone, I think out of, we had 21 boats start and 14 finished. And it actually was, I think, the highest percentage of finishers of all the Vonnegut Globes, that one event. I think we had a pretty good track record because, as many boats never make it to the, it's really hard to go all the way around the world without stopping and pull it off.
It's something not breaking that you can't fix.
It was interesting. I was taking a look at the boat Ocean Planet, and it was unique in its like creation and its design and your way of thinking with it. It was a wooden boat, right?
Yes, it was cold molded wood veneers over a foam core. So it was a composite boat. It was very light construction. It was very, very good construction. And the builder that did the Schooner Creek Boatworks in Portland, Oregon, had built a number of Tom Wiley designs using that technique already. And it had been proven as a very fast, fairly economical, but effective way to build boats. It's had plenty of, carbon and Kevlar and other modern materials in it. So it was unique construction in many ways. Probably the most visible feature on it that was unusual was the freestanding rig. It was 85 foot tall, unstayed mast that would, bend quite a bit, but that worked quite well. So it was a very effective rig and, took a lot of flack for it from naysayers who, thought that wasn't a very good idea. But I was one of the few people that never had to go up the rig the whole way around the world.
So our listeners understand this a little better. Describe that a little more for us.
It was a braided carbon tube, essentially like a giant fishing pole. It's made by Composite Engineering in Massachusetts. Ted Van Dusen, I don't think he owns that anymore, but he was the guy that designed that. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Tom Wiley design boats called the Wiley Cats. They were unstayed cat rigs. They're very popular on the West Coast. And the advantage of a rig that bends like that is it automatically flattens the sail quite well. Very hard to break. You think, gee, it's bending, it's going to break. But no, because it bends, it makes it very difficult to break. Ours was a little different because it was a fractional rig. We still had head soles and we had big, masthead spinnakers, but it was an unstayed mast. There were no shrouds. This set of running backstays, and that was it.
So you're sort of getting like nature to help you almost instead of working against you.
Yeah. You still have the reef and, a lot. It was a good rig for getting around the world on a skinny boat like that. And also because the boat was so skinny, we didn't have a very wide shroud base, which if you don't have a wide shroud base, you have more compression on the spar and it winds up having to be heavier because of the compression. So in that particular boat's case where it was rather slender, the overall weight of the whole thing was pretty similar to what it would have been with a stayed rig. On the wider boats, or the boats with the really wide deck spreaders that you see nowadays, those unstayed would be a performance disadvantage due to the heavier weight required. The much higher riding moment on the new boats, especially with the new foiling boats.
All the new designs have foils on them.
Yeah, so it's a whole different world now. But for when that boat was designed in 99, 2000, it was a pretty advanced boat and worked quite well and helped me do what the main goal was, which was to be the first American to finish. And I would say that if we'd been a couple of years sooner and we had, of course, always nice to say, if we had more money, had better sail development, and sails out, I think the boat could have done quite well in the 2000 race. Because they were still ironing out the wide boats and water ballast and cannon keel stuff. We're still getting sort of ironed out. And Ocean Planet could have done really pretty well in 2000 if it had been fully realized. But that's okay. I managed to finish and 4 years later and pull it off.
One of the questions I got is that, it sounds like you're the all-American man, right? You basically decide to get into the Vendée Globe. You create the Made in America Foundation to pretty much like crowdfund this. No American has completed it. When you were out there, did you feel like America was with you, right? Like, was that a driving force? Like, how did you think of that?
Yeah, well, there's a patriotic side to it, but definitely a responsibility side to it that all these people had pitched into it, and I didn't want to screw it up for them all. Mm. And you know, and there's so many volunteers work on the boat. You know, when in single-handed racing is anything but single-handed as far as getting to the event. There's so many people involved and volunteers and workers to make it all happen, and someone is the designated driver. That was me, but you feel a lot of responsibility to not screw it up. But I will point out that I had great following in France with France kids from schools that I saw before and after the race. We had a little education thing worked out. We had American schools following, not to the extent that Rich Wilson did when he went after me 4 years later. He did a really great job, built out a really big education, fully accredited education program. He took it to the next level on that. But that was a big part of it too, the inspiration of knowing that there's kids and people following. And it was across the board. I was amazed to discover after the race for years, I'd run into people that followed it that I wouldn't even have known. I mean, in weird places, I'd be at a ski resort hanging out and someone would go, "Hey, you're that guy. Did I bump your car in the parking lot? I don't know." No, you're the guy that round the world thing. And then one time, actually, the story I'm thinking of is a guy at a ski place. There were like two guys were in this room up at the ski resort. And one guy asked me that, "Hey, you're that guy." And the other guy goes, "Yeah, the round the world thing. There were two guys there and both had followed it." And it's amazing, you know, nowhere's near the water. And so the reach of the Vendée, you know, afterwards just amazed me and was bigger than I even thought it was when I was doing it.
And you'd mentioned that, like, you know, like a third of the boat didn't make it. Did you run into like crazy stuff? How did you make it?
Definitely. I mean, there's no way you can go that far without having some pretty stressful moments. I think some of the most stressful part for me was early on entering the Southern Ocean early on, very tight knit, high speed storm. There's one stretch where I had to drive like half a night. I didn't trust the autopilot, just nervousness. And I think I had the
fastest. And when we say, like, just to get a read on that, what were your instruments saying? 60 knot winds, 80 knot winds?
Oh, I don't know. That wasn't that much. Probably, you know, 50s.
50s. Okay, that's still most people's cup of tea.
Let's put it this way. I mean, nowadays, the boats are much faster, and the 24-hour speed record like over 21 knots average speed 24. But for me, there's a 6-hour stretch where I'm average like 17, 18 knots average speed.
Wow!
And that was you know, excessively exciting.
Yeah, unheard of, right?
for that time. And so, you know, the boat could go pretty fast, but that was faster than I wanted to go. But I was in a situation where I didn't want to stop driving and had to just keep going and wait for it all to wind down.
And you had an autopilot system? What were the autopilot system?
Oh, yeah. Like we had a very good, well thought out steering and autopilot system. That was all pretty good. But you know, no matter how good it is, you don't really want to find out what the limits of it are and hope something goes wrong. And it was much improved over the round alone. In the round alone, I had a couple bad crashes, one in the Southern Ocean where I broke the boom the second time. And so it turned out that the compass that we used the gyro compass could only heel over so far before it would not work. And so you get knocked down by a big wave. The compass would start putting out data. Your autopilot wouldn't have any data to go on. It would get lost and you'd slowly spill into a crash if you didn't get it unhooked and start driving soon enough. Eventually we learned, put it on a gimbal so that the compass doesn't heel too far.
Smart.
And so that was, you know, there's all these things you learn in the round alone.
Necessity, right?
But so in the Vendée, you know, the system was ironed out quite a bit, but that doesn't mean you're not, you know, nervous as hell in a big storm when there's so far to go and, you know, it's not stopping. The round alone, we had a few stops and you have to keep going. And so, you know, there's some stress just trying to make it to the end. I think psychologically, as I got toward the end of the Vendée, I remember being just wondering if something was going to go wrong, you know, toward the last, you know, beating up the Atlantic, getting through the traffic and getting through the stuff in the biggest case. The closer you get to the end, the more suspicious I became that something was going to go wrong. And, but in the end, you pull it all off. So I think psychologically toward the end, you know, I was just wondering, gee, what could go wrong? And you know, if you've read all the other books about the history of round the world racing, like the Golden Globe race, where's that one guy in the trimaran who made it almost to the end? Nigel Tetley. And his trimaran fell apart. He almost made it. And in fact, he'd crossed his path. He'd effectively gone around the world and his boat fell apart. And Those are great stories, by the way. I sort of got into
that. Yeah, that's what you're saving for your book. I love it. Right? But you're obviously part of the whole psychological thing is that you're also not getting much sleep, right? How much are you sleeping at this time?
I was sleeping 20-minute sessions. That was my pattern. Everyone has a different pattern that they do to that you fall into. If in conditions, I would do lots of those 20-minute sessions, you know, throughout the day and night. And my overall sleep would be pretty good. But then there'll be cases where it'd be several days. We only get a couple of them. So it all depends on the conditions. And definitely get in the habit of trying to bank it up when possible.
Ready
when things go bad.
I listened to some of your interviews from the Vendée Globe. And I guess the way your keel was shaped, it made this crazy sound. And our viewers will have to listen to a few of the videos that you have on YouTube.
Yeah, there's some good ones up there. It's howled. It would definitely howl at high speed, which is pretty common. Even the new boats, someone will do that. It has something to do with the trailing edges on the foils that everyone's always trying to. That's a classic debate of what you do with the trailing edges of your foils to try and stop that infernal noise.
But it was like it was such a terrifying noise. I'm like, oh my God, that sounds just so ominous, like this constant like hum. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's because it's literally slicing
it means you're going
through the water.
Fast, though. It means you're going fast. So at a certain point, it's like, hey, we're going fast. And this is a good sound. But at a certain point, it does get a little
scary. Yeah, that's your acoustic speedometer.
this is a good spot to really try to figure out a little bit more about that, how you got into energy. You know, it seems like you went from.
Mayor, before we go there, remember your original question was, Bruce, what is sailing to you? And then we went down this whole giant story. So at the end of that, what is sailing to you?
Well, for me, it's different for everybody. For me, it's an application. Well, it's a great mix of physical sensations, especially on fast boats. I mean, I really like sailing on fast boats. I physically tie into the feeling of the wind and the way the boat goes through the water. For me, that physical sensation and connection with the boat is really fun, especially off the wind sailing and surfing. That whole physical sensation of surfing is so much fun. It's like mountain biking on, you know, great corners.
Mountain road.
So it's that physical mixture with the mental part of it. There's just so much data and stuff to absorb and get in and tie into with the sail trim, the angles.
So almost like becoming one with the boat.
Yeah, with the physical, that becoming one with the boat, physical part of it, and then the mental numbers part of it, which is fun to do. And the strategy of working wind angles and analysis of it is just so involving that it can be pretty addicting, the whole thing sailboat racing. I haven't been doing so much of it the past few years. I've obviously had my fill with 2 trips around the world and I think 6 Hawaii races and 4 transatlantics. And so I've had, you know, quite enough sailing for a while. But I do want to do some more on my boat Improbable, the one that I lived on when my dad had when I was in high school.
Nice.
That's a whole other story we can get into. I do want to do some more, couple more Hawaii races and then a little more cruising, but I'm not going to go around the world again.
Okay.
I do want to point out that I was the first American to officially finish, but I'm not the first American to do it. Mike Plant should be recognized as the first American to try it, and that he finished but unofficially because he had to get some help. So he was disqualified, but you know, he's a great story. Mike Plant was a there's a movie out about him called Coyote. He's a crazy guy. And then before him, we should recognize Dodge Morgan, who's the guy who spent a lot of time in Maine and New England, who did his own self-funded trip before the Vendée Globe even existed. And he went around the world and sent a bunch of races on a boat that he had built for himself, American Promise. And that's I met him. He was on our board for a while of the foundation that owned the boat. And he was a great advisor and a great influence. What a character. So he passed away.
I bet you meet interesting people. I mean, that, like you said, you need to be a certain kind of crazy to even try it.
Right? Yeah, there's a lot of... Yeah, the whole vortex of Ocean Planet, the boat, in that program, and the people that it brought in from all over the world, from France to New Zealand, in the round alone, to all these different countries, and people from all over the U.S., from who come in and help on the boat, from wherever, that whole vortex and people involved, is literally hundreds of people who are involved in the whole program in one way or another, and all the donors, it was a big thing. I mean, it had a lot of gravity to it and a lot of stuff. So it changed my life. And when it came out of that, you know, I was a little lost for a while with all the financial stuff that went on and trying to figure out what to do with myself. But it turned out that I had become, and this segues into Meryl's question.
Meryl's question, exactly.
I became sort of an energy geek, as many people will do when you spend a lot of time staring at the battery monitor, wondering if you have to recharge the batteries. And I was lucky that I was a yacht rigger. I didn't know diddly about electrical systems when I started all that stuff. And I was lucky that the place I worked at, Svenson's Marine in Alameda, California, I'd worked there for almost 20 years. A guy who's in the same complex there, Lem Dowd, LTD Marine, and he's still a really, really highly recognized electrical installer in the area there. He was my guru electrical system. He set up Ocean Planet for me and he just said, you're not going to go around the world with, you know, I'm not going to let you go without having a good system on there. And so he designed a system, and I, you know, spent my time learning what I had, what he had put together in there. And that was a lot of my education. It's really
and so back then, so what sort of system are you talking about?
Well, back then it was before the days of lithium batteries. We had gel batteries, and we had a high power 24 volt alternator. So 24 volt.
Oh, those system. Alternators were already making their way into, because I thought that was a newer innovation.
No. High power alternator has been around for quite some time. The regulators were advanced. We had, for the time, we had the most advanced alternator regulator you could get. This was back when Ample Power was out. We had the SAR V3, the early days of smart alternator regulators. So I got to, you know, I was up on the latest stuff of the time, thanks to my friend Lam, who set all that up. And the solar had lots of solar on there, and solar controllers, and good battery monitoring system to see all this stuff and be able to manage my loads and be able to make decisions and say, well, you know, I'm getting a little low, but in a couple hours, the sun's going to be up. And the way the boat's healed here in the South Atlantic, I know that I'm going to get a pile of, on this jibe in the motor, I'm going to get a lot of power from the solar, and I won't have to charge, you know, if things go well. I mean, I went for 3 days once without charging at all with the engine, just because I was able to work the solar and tie it into to collect as much energy as possible. Which, again, the Southern Ocean, there's a lot more clouds than you had to use the engine more to charge. But that managing, you know, the energy and the energy storage and the use of it became a habit. And when another one of my Ocean Planet team members, a friend of mine out in California, Greg Nelson, was getting into lithium batteries afterwards, and he and I started marketing some early forms of lithium batteries early in the game before we learned that more advanced electric control systems, you know, BMS, we say, you hear the acronym BMS a lot, which means battery management system, was an important part of lithium battery systems. So I learned pretty early on that, fortunately, I didn't have any, you know, big fires or anything or burn any boats down, but I learned that we needed more integrated systems. And that's what we do now. So I've sort of grown. I'm not an electrical engineer. One of my employees, one of our partners, Julia Carlton, she's an electrical engineer. And of course, Nigel Calder, his partner, he's a legend in the business. I'm just a sailor that has stared at battery monitors a whole lot. But I got started with lithium batteries pretty early in the game. So
and this is when they were still dangerous.
Well, yeah, they could be. Yep, they definitely could be. And I've been able to stay up with all the systems and what the right way to do lithium batteries is for large applications. And there's different horses for different courses. And that's sort of our game here, is doing the more high-end at Ocean Planet Energy, which we kind of named after the boat. It's a business I run now. Our bread and butter is the little bit larger integrated systems that have very powerful charging and large energy storage, where people want to run, say, air conditioning all night long, which is something you never would do off lead batteries before. And charge it all up in an hour and a half in the morning.
What?
It takes a whole lot of charging power. So having a system that can do that, but lithium batteries allows you to do that, but to have that, to move that kind of energy around with high power alternators, all takes integration and a control system that I didn't know it when I was staring at that amp power monitor and had my SAR V3 regulator in 2002. I didn't know that I was beginning my training how to do these systems now for bigger boats. And our market isn't racing boats. Racing boats don't have that much load.
You're just, everyone's your market. All the cruisers.
It's the cruisers.
Don't want to run the generator.
They don't want to have a generator, or at least limit the use of it, and want to have some amenities on the boat. They need to create the power and store it to have those amenities. That's the market we.
Well, it sounds like you came in kind of very early on to the whole kind of renewable energy charging systems on yachts. How has it changed over the years that you've been in it? It obviously seems like a lot more people are getting into it and considering it, and especially with the fuel prices these days, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You still can't beat the energy density of fuel. The energy density of a fuel, if working with the renewables teaches you anything, it's that how amazing diesel is. But then now that you recognize how amazing and valuable it is, how do you get the most possible out of every pint of that fuel? Now it's more expensive, and that can be done so much better than traditional energy systems have. Traditional alternators that come stock on an engine, if you're going to charge with those, it's incredibly inefficient for the amount, the cost per kilowatt hour. If you amortize the wear and tear on the engine, the amount of fuel you have to burn, you know, the amount of time you have to run it, and there's all these reasons why.
Do we have any numbers on that? Like, is it like?
Oh, Nigel has more fantastic efficient numbers on it. Nigel has got great articles on the cost per kilowatt hour of the energy. It, depending on where you get it from, you know, he does seminars and stories on the stuff. He's a wealth of information. If you're able to load up your device, that's whether it's a generator or whether it's an engine, if you are able to load it up so it's charging, you know, close to what it can produce, it's better to load them up than to run them in lightly loaded. They'll burn fuel when they're running, whether they're lightly loaded or not. So you want to load it up. It's better for a diesel engine to do that. Then it becomes much more cost efficient if you're able to wring, you know, much more kilowatt hours out of those drops of diesel and put them somewhere, you know, in the batteries. And so you asked what had changed over the years. And the alternators, you know, big alternators have been around for many, many decades for different applications, but they've gotten more advanced and smaller for a given amount of power that they can do. Higher voltage systems are coming into play. We sell more 24-volt systems now than we do 12-volt ones. And we're starting to sell more 48-volt systems.
48, yep.
Which is actually 51-volt lithium systems. And the amount of power you can get from the same size alternator, it's almost twice as much for the same size alternator as it would be on a 12-volt one if you go to a 48-volt one. Exact same thing. And it's a little bit more load on it, but it's just so much more efficient because it's less amps for a given amount of kilowatts. So the efficiency of the units has improved. The electric, the integration, the smarts of everything has improved. Like I mentioned, the smart alternator regulator that I had at the time, those just the last couple of years, companies like Wakespeed have been developing much more advanced alternator regulators that communicate with the CAN bus data from the advanced battery BMSs, the brains of the batteries. And they've worked out the algorithms to communicate with, you know, Victron batteries, Lithionics batteries, you know, other batteries that are out there in the market, so that you can plug these things together and you have much more controlled, graduated, powerful charging. If you're going to be charging really fast, you just don't want it to be safe. You want it to be, you want your batteries to last a long time, and you want to monitor battery temperature, not just voltage, you know, watch the current, watch all these features. It's a lot of data involved now. So it is it is complicated, and there's a lot of features to program into these things when you set them up. But when you get it all set up right, it's amazing the amount of energy you can move around.
For sure. And I definitely consider myself a big energy geek, and just wanted to like get your opinion on, for example, solar specifically. Is it a huge fan of solar on boats? I think we need more solar on boats. What about like broader than that, though, in terms of energy? Is solar going to solve all the problems beyond boats as well?
Solar is definitely an answer for cruising boats that are low energy load. If you don't have, if you're not trying to run air conditioning all night long, then solar can, and with the advent of more efficient refrigeration, that's one of the biggest loads on cruising boats is refrigeration.
For sure.
But they've gotten much more efficient. So with the advent of lithium batteries, which store battery better, store energy better, the advent of more powerful solar panels, so there's more air, more power per square foot, and the advent of more efficient refrigeration, you can now run a decent fridge with not that much solar. So how much solar you need, there's math to be done to figure out what's the recommended amount to have, and then you need to have sun, right? It's not going to work in the rain. So solar can be the primary energy source on a lot of boats if the loads aren't too high, but you still need to have a backup system because you're still going to need fuel when the sun doesn't shine or when something happens. So a lot of boats, when they do an energy system upgrade, kind of address both the fuel efficiency charging and the solar at the same time. And so when they go to do a system refit, they'll be upgrading their alternator, they'll be getting an alternator regulator, pulley kit on the engine to work that alternator. They'll get solar, they get solar regulators, they'll get a new battery monitoring system so they can monitor all the stuff and see what's going on. So it's common for this to kind of happen all at once, and you want it to get all integrated and you all work together. And so that's our game
is what you guys offer.
Yeah. To kind of say, well, you're going to use this and this talk to this and this talk to everything, knows what's going on. And then we create a system diagram. So the installers actually have a plan that, so everyone knows here's what we're shooting for. This is where all the main parts are going to be. And this is how it's all basically connected, how the networking works. People need to know, since the BMS, the battery system, needs to communicate with the regulator, how does that all plug together? Where's it go to the monitoring? And so we do diagrams that kind of show, what plugs into what.
And obviously, and this sounds super technical to lots of our listeners probably, but one way is obviously just to get Bruce's company to figure everything out for you, or do it the way Bruce did, right? You started off with, I started off with a 10-watt panel and now have a kilowatt on top, right? Start super small and just figure it out piece by piece yourself.
It's true, if you have the time.
Yeah.
Well, as soon as you brought up refrigeration, I was like, okay, now I see the connection. Lexi from Boat RX.
Those guys are great. They're really doing a great job with air conditioning and refrigeration. And they're really big on efficient air conditioning. In fact, I think they have more data, real live data from testing, as far as there's all these metrics, right? I mean, now the new metric electric cars is miles per kilowatt hour. Forget about miles per gallon. It's miles per kilowatt hour. So all these, but they have all these metrics on BTUs per kilowatt of electricity. So how much can your air conditioning system deliver for how much electricity is taken from your batteries? Whether it's 12 volt or 24 volt or 48 volt or running on AC, 120 or 240 or European 230. It's, they've got a pretty good database, good knowledge of what's the best air conditioning system, most efficient for your particular application, how big your boat is, and how much area you have. So they're doing a great job, and they're doing installation. That's Lexi and Phil Gutowski at BoatRx. So we work with them a lot, and we sell them alternator systems and batteries if they need it from us. And
we had the pleasure of interviewing them. They were one of our first shows. I think our listeners, some of them who've heard our first few shows, might remember Lexi. But he had so many cool ideas, and it's funny. He had said that a lot of them he was getting from not within the U.S. Like, he was, going to Europe, and these guys were doing these crazy new things, and he's like, we need more of this there. And I think that's huge. I think that's part of the whole industry, is sharing technology like that, just making everybody better.
Yeah, and they weren't afraid to go learn and travel to find out what the best stuff is. And right here in Maine, one of the big projects we're doing at a great boatyard, Great Island Boatyard, Harpswell, Maine here, we have a boat with a 51-volt lithium system. It's being charged with the Integral, which is like the highest power alternators you can get. Nigel was involved in those. So this boat has a massive 51-volt system. It's got twin engines with these Integrals on it. It can charge an enormous power. And they happen to have the Thermodynamica air conditioning system installed by Boat RX. So it's that this is a boat where they've gotten all these systems on there, where this boat can have a pretty luxurious amenities for...
And no generator.
That's right. But it's no generator.
So I got to hear your take on the age-old question of, solar versus wind versus hydro, or a combination of all three, or...
Nuclear. Yeah.
Well, we aren't selling nuclear reactors for boats yet. We don't have
them yet.
Well, unless you want to buy an aircraft carrier. But the combination of all this stuff is definitely improved and the integration of making it all work is definitely improved. But solar can do quite a bit. And as for what the mix is, depends on where you're going to go. If you want to cruise Newfoundland and stuff and where it's foggy a lot, you know, maybe wind is a good thing to have where it's windy a lot, but foggy. In general, wind has sort of fallen out of favor a little bit in favor of more solar if you can fit it, but they do complement each other. The one tricky thing with wind is that they're usually, and I'll get a little technical here, they're usually permanent magnet motors, and so the controllers are different. In an alternator, you control the magnetism of the motor and the rotor in there with a regulator that controls how magnetized that rotor is. And if it doesn't want it to run, it turns off that magnetism, it turns off the voltage feeding the rotor, and then it doesn't do anything. It just spins. Well, if it's a permanent magnet motor up in a wind generator, it goes to a different type of regulator. It can't really turn it off.
It has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
The electricity. Yeah.
And with you have lithium batteries have to be able to turn off the charge sources. So the integration of a wind generator system into a lithium battery system gets a little bit more complicated because they're harder to turn off.
I've seen some people, again, other energy geeks are messing with a system where as soon as the batteries are charged, they'll divert all the extra amperage into, you know, heating their water or something.
Yeah, and you can divert, you can do that. And you could, I think some of the answers some folks are doing now is that rather than mess around with the complication of trying to integrate the BMS to control the wind and the relays and stuff, they just direct it to a lead battery and then use a B2B charger from that when it's charged to move energy to the house battery in a controlled manner or divert it to a water heater or something the old-fashioned way. So and even on these boats with lithium batteries, you'll often find several lead batteries on board to do certain tasks. For instance, starting the engines. You don't want that on the same circuits as your house loads. And the starting batteries don't necessarily need to be that big. So you're not going to say that much weight. So you should better stick with lead batteries for your starting and then charge those from the house bank, which is where most of the energy is. But you can use that to charge your house banks or for your bow thruster and windlass up in the front of the boat. That is probably just might as well be a lead battery. It's less expensive. And then charge that from the house bank as well. So picking the right, knowing the loads and picking the right batteries for those applications, choosing the right sources, depending on where you're going to go. If you have enough room for solar, some boats don't have much room for solar and they're going to use fuel. I would say this, here's a very, very crude analogy trying to decide whether you should go with like lead batteries or lithium batteries. If you can get enough solar, if you do your loads are low enough to where you got refrigeration, you got a couple of little things, that if your solar, if you can get enough on there to cover all your loads, and then a little bit extra, so you know you can charge quickly after some cloudy days and stuff. Lead batteries are going to be fine. Lead batteries last years and years if they just get charged often enough. They don't like sitting partially charged. They'll deteriorate. But if you can get enough solar to do that, stick with lead batteries and put as much solar on as you can get. If your loads are high enough and you have limited space for solar or just not enough to cover whatever your high enough loads are and you have to charge with fuel, and it means you're running an engine or a generator and you want to move energy into your batteries and you want to spend as little time doing it as possible, then lithium batteries are going to make sense. Because once you have to charge with fuel, it takes so long to fully charge a lead battery that it's very inefficient to charge them from alternators and stuff where you don't want to run it for alternator low load for a couple hours just to top off your lead batteries. So it's a very crude analogy, but that's basically a good rough set of parameters, right? If you can cover your loads with solar, you're going to be fine with lead. And if you need to charge with fuel, lithium is worth looking at.
And at the same time, I think now there's also little gizmos that let the batteries talk to each other better, right? Different sort of chemistries as well.
Well, that's what we call B2B chargers. I may have said that earlier without explaining it. Sorry. A B2B charger is essentially a DC-DC converter that has a programmable output from the source. From the source battery, its target battery output has a programmable, what's multi-stage charging, where it has an absorption voltage and a flow voltage. It'll properly maintain the battery that's on the source side, and it'll turn off if the input voltage is too low. You can program all these things to where don't turn on if you're discharging the house bank too low. Just turn off and let the starting battery stay charged, and the next time you're charging, it'll automatically turn on. So we use those a lot. What we call B2B chargers. Essentially just B2B. Smart, yeah, battery to battery. It's essentially a smart DC-DC converter. Victron makes a bunch of those.
That's what I was thinking. I have a little Victron gizmo.
Yeah, Sterling smart Power made them for thing. for years. Yeah. On Victron has taken over some of the market from the Sterling Power ones, but Sterling Power still has some more powerful ones for sometimes with the if the battery when a charge takes more load, you might still use a Sterling one.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Victron stuff. Huge.
Yep. They make that's a great product line, and they're always improving, coming out with new stuff. So we sell a lot of Victron. We're a Victron distributor here, so work with them a lot.
Well, it sounds like you've managed to put yourself in the right place in the right time multiple times. You know, like you grew up sailing in the 70s, right? A huge height of sailing. And then you were kind of a first mover in the renewable energy space when it comes to boats. So where do you think the industry is headed when it comes to renewables on boats? Like, what can we see in the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years?
I think the system integration side of things will continue to evolve, and you're seeing a number of big players in the market work harder on that. By integration, I mean plug and play communication between different devices and monitoring.
And it's already almost like that, right? It's almost like Lego that way, isn't it?
Yeah, but you have to make sure that you have protocols that are compatible, you know, like, you know, Victron VE.CAN, they talk on their own. So you just can't plug everything together. You certainly can't plug your MasterVolt CAN bus stuff into your Victron stuff, expect them to get along because they use their different protocols. Mm-hmm. So, but I think that's going to become, MasterVolt's been on the forefront of doing CAN bus communication for quite some time. They were doing MasterBus CAN bus communication with their devices, you know, probably before probably anyone else was. One mistake I think they've made is not working together with some of the other players in the market they've been so closed about their system in there. They never worked out a deal with wake speed. So now it's so difficult to get MasterVolt lithium battery to work with wake speed because they won't disclose their protocol at all and let anyone know it. So they're kind of missing out on some developments there. But other battery manufacturers, you know, Lithionix and Victron have been working closely with wake speed. They work on that integration. Now you can get a Victron battery display. I mean, a Lithionix battery to display on a Victron monitoring system, and you can get wake speed display on a Victron monitoring system. You know, Victron's been doing a great job with their GX platform, with their GX monitoring, and the fact that you can tie that to VRM there, so you can view them remotely. Like, we have clients' systems we can review remotely from like wherever they are, and we can reprogram their stuff, you know, virtually from the internet, you know, if they're connected, if they're online.
And does this like tie into NEMA type networks as well, or do NEMA those type, not speak yet?
Well, there's different protocols. For instance, in the marine biz, you have NEMA 2000 or N2K. It's very similar. It's CAN bus. And in the RV industry, you have RVC that is very, very similar, but they're different PGNs, different parameter group numbers, and they're not exactly the same. They're just the same sort of format, but they're just different numbers and different things. So getting those to integrate and talk to each other requires a little bit of stuff. So what's going to improve is the integration between these different platforms and gateways between them to make things more plug and play and a little bit more refined. And hopefully, you know, we've been on the cutting edge of this stuff, and it's been labor intensive and support intensive as some of these great features have come into play, but it's not like everyone knows how to program this stuff and there's a million features to program. And so installers have been used to doing things the old way. You know, it's a big challenge to learn something new and learn how to set all this stuff up. And I think there's a big demand now for installers that are up on these new integration systems on there. Keeping my crew here, keeping personnel that are growing with this stuff and learning it. That's a challenge, getting young people into our industry that want to stick with it, that don't get pulled off by other industries that pay them more is a real challenge.
Well, here's a question. You know, for a young person that's thinking about coming into the industry, obviously there's tons of opportunity in it. How would you recommend them kind of navigate the waters of getting into it?
Well, the first thing you do is read Nadal's books. Right? Yeah, those are
good. We're hopefully going to have him on the show after all this. Yeah.
Oh, you should. Yeah, I should.
Nigel, yeah.
Yeah, but actually, you know what you should do first is one of the first things is on our website, on our support page, there's a link to this boat how-to course.
Go to oceanplanetenergy.com. We'll definitely put a link for that in the description.
Yeah, go to the short support how-to, and there's a link there. It goes to an online marine electrical systems course that Nigel developed with his partner Jan and some other guys in Europe. And it's a very thorough, starts at the very beginning electrical concepts, and takes you all the way through to calculating all your loads and what you need for charging and all that stuff. It's very, very well done.
That's huge. Thank you.
And I think that's worth doing whether you're interested in being an installer or just have your own boat and want to know how the heck everything works.
Okay. And then just, are you saying get your hands dirty after that?
Yeah, well, you decide how much you want to do. I mean, I think a lot of people do this stuff so they know it, and then they hire someone to do it because they know it, they realize, boy, this is a lot of work. But at least they know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So you're also big in kind of like the ocean space and like, you know, all of that. So how do you see kind of the state of our oceans and the energy scene in general, kind of outside of sailing or cruising or anything like that?
Well, I think that it's a little unrealistic to eradicate the use of fossil fuels, especially in marine, because we have to. But at least we can become more efficient and use less of it and pollute a whole lot less. And having run into a lot of crud in the oceans, pollution is something I'm personally aware of. And which, to take a little bit of a sidetrack here, in this endless debate about whether global warming is caused by humans, and this, you know, we have these just camps between right and left and global warming and energy stuff. And I think that the whole thing is framed in the wrong way.
What do you mean?
In that if you take a view from the slight libertarian approach, the libertarian mindset, and the protection of individual rights point of view, which some people identify with being anti-climate supporting. But if you take the point of view that every individual needs to have their rights protected, that none of us really have the right to pollute and poison the air and property of other of our fellow citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that from the purest, even from the conservative purest point of view, a clean energy systems should be a matter of principle, because you should not be, your pickup truck shouldn't be belching black smoke that could make someone else sick. Mm-hmm. It's a violation of rights. And I think the whole thing, that's why I really like the focus in discussions when we start talking about climate change is in terms of pollution and poisons. And then, CO2 and gases like that, do play a role, and you can get into the metric. They can argue about that forever. But from a standpoint of principle, I just think we need to have cleaner systems, both on and off the water, from the sense of just caring for our fellow citizens and the people that we live together with. It really makes a difference. As a cyclist, as someone who rides on the road a lot, I mean, there's a real difference in the amount of junk I have to breathe from one car to the next as they go by. And I know, being from having spent much of my life in California, the emissions standards there are quite onerous and add expense to the cars. But you can ride a bike through downtown Oakland, California, through the midst of the barrio, and it's less dirty than it is to follow one pickup truck here in Maine. So these emissions standards and stuff play a role, and there's a reason for them. And I don't think it should be framed as a right versus left thing. It should be framed as a pollution and individual protection of individuals thing. And I think that kind of argument, anyway, I like to think that argument would be more successful in getting people together on the whole environmental issues. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's my personal rant.
Well, as we start to wrap this up, could you give one or two pieces of advice that you received along the way that has really kind of helped guide you?
Too many. Yeah. So I remember one thing Dodge Morgan said when we were at it was a fundraising function. He was speaking on our behalf. Governor Maine was there, and he was speaking to everybody. He turned over and looked at me and says, "Bruce, I want you to know that winning isn't everything. Wanting to is." That was a good one. And
love it.
And I suppose another saying I should point out that I had a great partner in my build up to the Vendée Globe who put up with my sailing and years of involvement to pull the thing off. But through the Vendée Globe, I ran off with a crazy French girl. And I wanted a bit of advice I'll give people is that do not make relationship decisions after 110 days at sea.
That's funny. So I just want to tap that a little more. You've got so much experience under your belt, right? Like you're now early 60s, I think, right?
Wow. Yeah, 60, okay. 62. But trying to stay young, you know.
Yeah, you don't sound a day over 50. So how do you do it? What do you do?
Well, that reminds me of a great quote by Groucho Marx, but I won't say in the interview here because you'd have to cut it out. But I race bikes. I ride bikes a lot and work out to try and stay in shape. I've always been enjoyed athletic activities. I was a wrestler in high school and I even boxed for a while after school. But I enjoy bike riding and both for recreation and for competition. In the fall, the sport that I like to do here in New England is very popular. It's called cyclocross, which is kind of a cross between mountain biking and road biking. And the bikes look like road bikes, but have a little bit fatter tires, and they race across grassy fields and into the woods. And you carry the bike on your back, like up a hill, or jump over barriers and slide around in the mud. It takes place in the fall and early winter. You look it up on YouTube.
I'll have to check that out. For sure.
It's great. It's great fun. Yeah. People, the crowds rattled cowbells and heckled the competitors, and we heckle each other in different categories. Well, I race masters. Age graded cyclocross in the fall and racing the 60 plus. I've gone to the nationals a couple times and I'll be, you know, gunning for nationals again this year. And so,
wow.
Every now and then, wow. I just like to see how I can do competing against a bunch of other crazy old guys who are trying to stay young and have fun. And it's a ridiculous sport, but that's the best thing about it, right? It's completely pointless.
Love it. And I understand you play the guitar as well. Does that have anything to do with keeping you young?
Oh, maybe. My girlfriend, Rosalie, is a professional piano teacher and a great piano player. And I've been playing guitar since I was 9.
Wow.
In the Von Day, I brought a little guitar along. Almost never played it, but I brought one a little longer. And I have a good collection of acoustic guitars and very good classical.
What does collection mean?
There's three main guitars. Uh-huh. Not like Bob Perry we were talking about before the show. He's got piles of them, but really? I do have eight bicycles, so I'm pretty bad at collecting bicycles. But wow. I have my three main guitars. I have a Guild 12 string. And I have a very good custom-made classical, and I have my steel six string is from around 1890, so a Parley guitar made by Bay State.
And this is acoustic, obviously?
Yeah, acoustic guitar, right? Yeah. Wow. Have you ever heard of, if any of you have ever heard of Leo Kottke, he's probably my biggest influence.
Really?
I play a number of Leo Kottke tunes. He's an American guitarist from Minnesota.
Lee Kottke or Leo Kottke?
Leo Kottke.
Leo.
Leo, and he is very influential. Me, you know, Mr. Master, probably an American treasure, one of the greatest acoustic guitars ever. So I played some of his tunes. I played some original tunes. Some of those finger style guitar, some ragtime, some blues.
Have you ever put out tracks or CD or anything?
I did put out a CD soon after the Von Day. That was so a long time ago. I mixed up some six string bass stuff with my acoustic stuff, and I need to do some more recording. I'm hoping to get to that.
Do it. Yeah.
I play a lot of different tunes now than I did back then. We'll see. I have some friends here in Maine with a good recording studio and hope to get around to that. You know how it is. Business and then, you know, I spread thin with my, I still have a boat addiction. Mm-hmm. Aside from the bike racing and the guitar playing, I have the boat now. That my dad bought when I was 16 years old. Mm. I lived aboard.
Mm. We've been waiting for this story, right?
Yeah. And he passed away a few years ago, and I wound up with the boat named Improbable. It was built in 1970. It was built in New Zealand out of Cowrywood, cold molded out of Cowrywood. And it was a famous race boat back in the day and revolutionary in its own way. And I probably just should have sold it. You think I would know better with all my years of playing on boats, but I just can't resist doing all the stuff to it that I always dreamed of doing since I was a kid. And so I've torn the boat apart and I'm completely rebuilding it. Anyone wants to know just how bad I've gotten on all this, you go to projectimprobable.com.
Okay.
Which, and there's a video in there kind of explaining the whole thing. And I have some content there showing my overview of each area of renovation that I'm working on, you know, the rudder, the mast and sails, the deck layout. I have an overview trying to explain. I still have to get more content up there explaining all the details of it. You know, everything that's been in my head for years, I'm going to get it all out there and explain. what I'm doing and why. And so I hope to get that boat and up and running in within a couple of years and do another Hawaii Racer 2, another Pacific Cup. I don't think I'll need to do a single-handed chance.
You're going
to
race it again?
What? Yep. I want to. Yep. I'm going to do the Racer 2 to Hawaii. Do a nice downwind run, and then cruise around the Northwest. Get up to maybe bring it back from Hawaii to Alaska. Cruise down the coast of the Northwest. Do some maybe a little bit of coastal racing.
So that's one of the future plans. What other future plans do you have, Bruce?
Get top 10 at Cyclocross Nationals. That's one of my future plans.
Love it. Okay.
We'll see how that goes. You know, but Cyclocross. It's it's something to keep you healthy and something to do. I'm never. Was that gifted to become a pro bike racer. I raced when I was young. I raced road nationals, back in the 90s. I got clobbered. But we have a saying about cyclocross. Cyclocross is not a matter of life or death. It's more important than either one.
Wow.
But that's just a joke, right? I mean, it's just a silly,
Yeah, keeps guys. You moving.
Keeps you moving. In there. And right? Okay. I always hope to improve my music, guitar playing and stuff. So,
Writing a book, aren't you?
No, I hope to put one together that's derived from all the stories that I wrote over the Ocean
Please
Planet
do.
Years.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of stories and updates and, but as I look back, most of them were begging for money, but there's still good stuff in there. adventure. And someone was going to help me write and put together a book on that. I need to follow up with them and see if they're
made it. Yeah. Right. Get an album out. Get a book out. Win the cyclocross. Let's do it.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. Yeah. Well, so yeah, as you can see, I'm one of those guys that just is kind of bouncing off the walls, doing lots of different things. Probably trying to do too much, but yeah, I can't resist.
Well, but I really want to, for our listeners, sort of draw that together. Like maybe as a lesson, what can people listening to this? How do you stay so driven and so involved and 100% there for all of these things? You know, you've been playing guitar since 9 years old and you're still playing it, and I bet you're good, yeah? So, like, how do you stay that committed for that long to your passions?
Well, maybe it's the fact that I bounce around between different passions so much that each one of them is still pretty new to me when I come back to it.
I like that.
Very interesting. Yeah.
Scattered enough to where if I get bored with one thing, I just go work on the other for a while, and then I turn around and
you still love it. So you're like, yeah, I'm going to do this until I get sick of it again. Yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe it's my nature to. Maybe it's because I have a short attention span. But you know, on the other hand, my long-term attention span is very good. I never would have pulled off the Vande if I just didn't keep hammering away at what the long-term goal was.
Hmm. And, so how do you stay aligned that way? How do you keep yourself focused on, I remember when Myron and I were trying to come south, the best advice to go was just point your bow south.
Well, you have to be willing to change. I think that you have to plan to some extent, but you have to be willing to change your plans to achieve what your long-term goal is. And so, I mean, if you know what you want to do, but are willing to adapt to get there, that is a key part of it. It's like training, it's like training for any sport. You have to prepare, and training for, programming alternator regulators, you have to start somewhere and just keep plugging away. And even if it seems daunting, you can do a little bit, walk away, come back to it. In my case, where some of the technical stuff I've had to learn was by necessity, so I didn't look like an idiot to my clients who wanted to buy the stuff from me and they have to learn about it. But fortunately for me, I like the stuff, and my background in sailing, has helped me to appreciate how cool the stuff is, and that energy systems, electrical, it's like magic. What it allows you to do, and we take so much of it for granted that the stuff works in our houses, but you develop a real appreciation for the energy that we use in our houses and how it works when you see how hard it is to keep similar systems running on a boat. And we've taken a lot energy wise, we've taken a lot for granted over the years, and with the cheap cost of fuel for years and the cheap grid energy we've had for years, it's been sort of unrealistic in some ways, and it's helped us build our economy. But energy is going to cost more, and it's not because of people think that's because political reasons or because we just don't want to drill baby drill, but it just plain costs a lot to get this energy out of the world. And I would say, don't fight efficiency. It's cool stuff, you know? I mean, it's I have an electric car, it's the cheapest electric car I could get, but I love seeing how many miles per kilowatt hour I can get. You know, being efficient with energy, it's not a bad thing it's a fun thing to get into, and stretching your fuel supplies and having to carry less jerry cans out to your boat because you have an energy system that makes for a better lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Well, Bruce, this was such a fascinating episode. Where can people find more about you and read about you and what you're doing with Ocean Planet?
Well, Ocean Planet Energy is pretty easy to find at oceanplanetenergy.com. And you can read a little bit there about me and Nigel and Julia and Tom and Devin, my crew here. And for my personal adventures on Improbable, go to projectimprobable.com. Mm-hmm. I do have some videos up on YouTube. If you Google Bruce Schwab guitar stuff, you'll find some stuff there. Some of those are almost like 15 years. They're really old and I need to improve them, but they are what they are. I'll get some better ones up soon. But there's
looking forward to that part the most. Yeah.
Cool.
Looking forward. But again, thank you so much, Bruce. That was very enlightening for everyone, I think.
Fun talking to you guys, and great nostalgia for me to walk back through all these adventures.
Yeah. Yeah. And hopefully we're going to make our way through your team now. They all sound like fun guys.
They are. Yeah. It's a good group.
Yep. Thank you so much again.
Awesome. All right. Good. Cheers. We'll see you guys later.
Take care.
Check back every Tuesday for our latest episode, and be sure to like, share, and subscribe to ShipShape.pro.